Take a network break, get a handful of virtual donuts, and hang on, because we got a heaping helping of news today. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. Also joining us for today's show is Yvonne Sharp. She blogs at esharp.net and co-hosts on the Network Collective podcast. Today's show is sponsored in part by the WAN Summit. It's a conference where you can learn how your peers are selecting and deploying SD-WAN, preparing their WAN for cloud and data center migrations, and more. WAN Summits are coming to New York, Frankfurt, London, and other cities. You can get details and sign up at wansummit.com and save 20% off with the code PacketPushers. That's wansummit.com. And stay tuned after the news for a sponsored Coffee Talk conversation with VMware. We're going to be talking about NSXT. That's a version of VMware's NSX network virtualization software. It can run on the KVM hypervisor and in containers, and designed for private and public clouds. All right, to the news, our lead story. The ASIC maker Broadcom has announced that it's releasing an open source SDK for the Tomahawk ASIC line.
This is big news, isn't it, Drew? Everybody's rubbing their shoulders. I tweeted about it this week, and lots of people just went nuts about the whole thing.
It's sort of cracking open one of the last black boxes in networking.
Yeah, well, this has always been the problem with networking is that the vendors always sold you the hardware and the operating system and the apps as a single mainframe style stack. But levering that apart has been incredibly difficult. I mean, Cisco's dominant position and their choice to pursue the, you know, we want to sell you the whole, get all the money in a single piece of value. We don't want to disaggregate, has been steadily being unpicked as the years go by. We've seen white box come out, you know, merchant silicon has been able to enable the development of white box. And then we've seen, you know, companies with specific skills develop operating systems that they use for themselves, but not release them into the open because the Broadcom chipset, which has been inside, the APIs and the SDKs that they use to program the silicon inside of those operating systems has been very rigidly closed and restricted. The stories I've heard from people is quite draconian, sort of, you know, not allowed to talk about anything about our SDK or our API. And now it's open source.
Right. If you were going to build on Broadcom in the past, you had to get a license for their SDK, and there were all kinds of NDAs and disclosures and rules around what you could and couldn't say about it.
That's right. So this is really exciting because that's an open. Now, the thing here is that I've spoken to a few different people about this. It's not may or may not be backward dated. That is, it may not necessarily be open sourcing the Trident 2 SDK. So if you've got existing white box switches, you may not necessarily be looking forward to getting access to these things. You may have to look at the Tomahawk 3 and going forward. So that's something. And I think also I was talking to Ben Pfaff from Open vSwitch, and he was pretty excited about this because now he'll be able to put Open vSwitch directly on top of an Ethernet switch. So if you can program an Open vSwitch in a Linux server, now you can program Open vSwitch in a switch, and boom, you're away. So, you know, that's the sort of scale of change that we're looking at here.
Right. Yvonne, any comments, quotes, quips?
Well, I just think this is more evidence of the pressure that all of our legacy vendors are seeing from cloud and hyperscale. And I think P4 and what's going on there has put a lot of pressure on Broadcom to try and keep up. And so it's interesting times. The industry's shaking and moving, and it's going to take a while to settle in. Mm.
Yeah, and I noticed reading the Broadcom press release with all their talk of openness and so on, P4 did not come up. I don't know if this is something that P4 could take advantage of, this SDK, but I've got to wonder if part of this was either pressure from P4 and Barefoot Networks or from Broadcom's big web-scale customer saying, you got to open this up a little bit more for us.
I see P4 as breaking away from Barefoot. Barefoot invented it so that programmability became a feature, which, of course, is their key feature. Mm-hmm. But it's very open source. They've been very open because they have to sort of break into that market. P4 sits above the SDK. So what that somebody needs now to write is a P4 to Broadcom compiler so that the P4 language can then be implemented on Broadcom ASICs. And when that comes about, or if that comes about, seems likely that it will, you should see some really interesting stuff following, because the apps that sit above it could start taking advantage of P4 to do the programming plane. So in the same way that you have, you know, people writing apps in Python that run scripts on operating systems, that will start to come to networking devices. Remember we talked about AT&T's DNOS a couple of weeks back?
Yep.
Think about generic NOS with a P4 compiler and then an app above it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And this is one step down that path. And we got more about DNOS later on in the show.
Hearing you talk about this makes me think, in the long term, this could be good for P4, which sort of becomes a shim between the ASIC and applications and operating systems above it.
I do think so. I've been rattling around the Valley now for this is my third week of being in Silicon Valley and meeting everybody and talking to everybody. And it seems fairly solid that a lot of people are looking towards P4 for exactly this reason. And there seems to be a lot of support for it. I don't want to sort of make, I haven't done like a detailed research and surveyed everybody and blah, blah, blah. But my off-the-cuff response is everybody's looking at P4 as a way to get this disaggregation underway because it allows them to do stuff that they couldn't do before.
That's right. All right, well, big news from Broadcom, and we'll keep an eye on this as it progresses. Moving on, yeah. Cisco has announced the Cisco Container Platform. This is a software package to support container-based applications, of course. Container Platform is going to be available on Cisco's HyperFlex HCI product in April of this year. Cisco says the software is Kubernetes-based, and it's a key component of a forthcoming hybrid cloud offering between Cisco and Google Cloud.
So only Cisco could make hardware-defined Kubernetes, really, couldn't they? that was my initial thought, and that's a really cheap shot. But it is something that Cisco is very good at because what they're saying is you have to have UCS to make this work, and you also have to have all of our custom software. So you have to be using HyperFlex, which is Cisco's UCS and their hyperconverged platform. And then they're releasing their own version of Kubernetes, which is custom written for this platform. And then, of course, they're also snapping in. The big weakness in Kubernetes remains networking. I think we've talked about Cisco Conti before. So Cisco's sort of bringing together the Conti project that they've been a part of, which combines a few different things that have been going on for a while based around the FD.io, the said FIDO of all things, project where they release the vector packet processing software into the public domain. It's still, you know, Kubernetes container network still looks like a roll Adobe cost with a fight club. It's just a disaster area. Really, Kubernetes has only been done in a very limited way. That is, one company is deploying one app. And when you start asking Kubernetes to deploy multiple apps and then having security between them, you actually end up with multiple Kubernetes deployments. And that doesn't scale very well. Now, that's not to say that startups can't make it scale and you can solve these problems one way or the other. You can. But the challenge, I think the winning part of this is that if people start to deploy stuff on Kubernetes, Cisco's now got a version of it. Maybe they start in the public cloud and then they bring it into the private cloud. And lo and behold, hyperconverge, snap together, HyperFlex. On top of that is this Cisco Kubernetes that they're talking together. And I think that's actually a viable strategy and probably the only way we're going to see the private cloud survive.
Interesting. I was trying to get a sense of where Kubernetes starts and Cisco Container Platform finishes. Like, what it sounds like there's an element of the full open source Kubernetes in this, but there may be some kind of Cisco wrap around it to, one, to optimize it for HCI, and two, make it a little bit more easy to use. And then, of course, they are plugging it into Conti, their virtual networking platform.
Yeah, well, Kubernetes needs a shim if you're going to scale out the networking and connect to your legacy and all that sort of stuff. But I think what we're seeing is what I call cloud tourism. That is, enterprises are going to go into the cloud and they're going to walk around and go, oh, so nice here. Everything is so lovely. The weather's great. Look, there's so much to see. And then a week later, they're going to be going, oh, you know, don't think I want to live here, though. It's lovely to visit.
And they're going to get the bill.
And then they're going to get the bill, and it's going to be like, and I call it the luxury hotel experience. You know, you go into the public cloud, and it's like going to a hotel. The sheets are changed every day. Someone cleans your room. There's a restaurant downstairs. It gets charged, you know, and then all of a sudden you start to realize that this luxury experience is fantastic and is lovely, but it costs a fortune. I saw someone put out a tweet this week. I think it was Mike Bouchon, and he said he was talking to an enterprise CEO, and he said, the cloud is a wonderful place to fail and an expensive place to succeed.
That's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, which is that, you know, luxury hotel. The point is, we all live in houses because the value of owning your accommodation accrues to you as people. It doesn't accrue to somebody else. If everybody lived in a, you know, and I think a lot of people actually think of the cloud as like a dormitory. It's cheap and it's crowded, but it's not cheap. It's actually a luxury hotel sort of pricing. And the private cloud, I think, still has a chance to win the long-term strategy if they can make the infrastructure look like the public cloud. So if you've got a situation where you go to the public cloud and then you do set up this stuff and then you port it back to the private cloud, you need this stuff, container platforms. Now, keep in mind that VMware has one of these as well, or something very similar to it.
Well, and I've been doing sort of an unscientific poll of the infrastructure folks I know, asking about what's our container strategy, or what's your container strategy, or what do you think of Kubernetes? And most of the enterprise folks I know, they aren't there yet. So I think, our Cisco, Juniper, VMware, they're trying to to take this technology and provide a path ahead for enterprises to say, here's how you come in and you do containers, and here's how you revolutionize, or, you know, they use that digital transformation buzzword. And so they're trying to come up with a strategy that they can sell to enterprises to push them onto their platform.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and especially based on a lot of the things we saw at Networking Field Day from VMware and Juniper in particular about their own integrations with Kubernetes. It seems like they are out in front of their enterprise customers as opposed to playing catch-up.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we have to have a strategy, but we don't actually want to buy it, which is always difficult for the vendors because they have to put in all the work to make a product that the customers may or may not want to buy. So, you know, I think ultimately, like VMware's PKCS has been on the table now for about 18 months. So for Cisco to react to that with this is actually quite necessary and probably the way the future of private cloud, I suspect.
And also very interesting, the fact that it's Kubernetes and sort of this explicit hybrid cloud plan with Google, who itself is trying to play catch up in the public cloud space. So these two sort of, I don't want to say second run, but, you know, they're sort of coming in from behind to try to have a hybrid private and public cloud strategy teaming up. It's interesting.
I think the polarization that we're seeing, which is very much this Cisco Google tie up versus the VMware AWS one, is not actually good for anybody.
Right.
you know, because most customers are going to be in multiple clouds, and it's pretty much going to be Azure and either AWS or Google. You know, everybody's got mail in, and Azure is, you know, very deep into the enterprise because of its Microsoft things. I do actually think Cisco might have picked the wrong partner here because AWS is far more the fashion, and fashion matters in enterprise IT. So, more than you think.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. You know, I'm not sure about AWS's relationship with Kubernetes and how much support they have at Google, sort of being the, you know, the home of Kubernetes and where it sprung from and making a lot of push behind it to be a Kubernetes-friendly platform for public cloud. Maybe in the long run, that'll make a difference. I don't know, though. I agree in terms of, you know, adoption, AWS is way far out in front.
But we're seeing it. Well, I see AWS is fashionable. I don't see it as being in front. Okay. You know, Google may be technically superior, but they don't have the fashion behind them. They're not coming out with the right color black, if you like.
Sure. I guess what I meant by out in front was in terms of adoption, not necessarily capability.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Moving on, sticking with Cisco, because they're at, while we're recording, it's Cisco Europe is wrapping up, so a lot of news coming out. Cisco announced the Network Assurance Engine.
Yeah, the Network Assurance Engine looks like a formal verification platform. I've been talking, you know, we've been talking about that for a while now with Forward Networks. We did a sponsored show with them just a couple of weeks ago, which seems to have hit a nerve with people, judging from the reactions. And also, we've talked to other people in that market. And now Cisco's come out with their own internally developed verification engine. So the idea is that Cisco is able to go and read all the configurations and state from the boxes, and then it's able to do some analysis. And from that analysis, they're going to be able to, you know, diagnose where the faults are, give you visibility, and also to verify if your network, you know, if you make a change in the network, is it actually going to be a viable change? Is it going to break something? So you'll be able to run tests. That should all be very familiar to you if you've been listening to the podcast that we've talked about formal verification over the last 2 or 3 months.
Right. That's being positioned as a key part of an intent-based networking system where you need to have an essentially real-time model of network state to be able to verify that changes were made and also potentially assess the impacts of a change, because you can do it in a modeling form before you actually push the real configs. Another startup is Veriflow that's in this space, and we've talked to them as well. So it definitely, if Cisco is going to be in intent-based networking, this is a key component they need.
Yeah. Now, my concerns here are it's been developed internally. History suggests that Cisco's internal software capability is pretty poor. So I would not rush out to, I wouldn't have high expectations of this because of that. And a second area of concern is that Cisco often announces these things prematurely when forced to by competition. So the fact that Veriflow and particularly Forward Networks has come out and got functional product that's being consumed by large customers. And I've been meeting with, I met with Forward Networks in last week, and they actually have some very large customers under their belt. So Cisco may be rushing this out so that their competitors don't get in before they sort of get into that market. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, if the product is rushed out and Cisco hasn't got a good history of getting, you know, good software out for a few years after it announces it, you know, it likes to announce early. So I wouldn't rush into this. I'd be cautious about what promises I made to the CIO before I...
Yeah, and I think part of the huge advantage of Forward and Veriflow and what they do is that it's cross-platform, that it will work across any network device in your environment and do some real modeling for you. So I'd be interested to see whether this network assurance engine is some conglomeration of existing products, if it is a unified solution, or if Cisco is doing the, I'm going to stitch a bunch of things I've already got together and call it something new, path, which they've done a couple times already with limited success. I'll say it that way.
Yeah.
You don't have to be so polite on the show, Yvonne. All right. Well, I have to say that the two stories we just talked about, Cisco's got some fire under its butt. You know, we can debate the quality of the products coming out, whether they're actually, you know, fully baked and whatnot, but the company is moving. This is not a company that's standing still anymore. It's not a company resting on its laurels.
Yeah. At the same time, Cisco's not been very good at moving. So keep in mind that Cisco hasn't done much innovation in the last 15 years. It's still selling switches that fundamentally identical to those from the late 1990s. So, and never been good at software. And now all of a sudden it's a software company. I think that's an exciting transition, but let's see if the proof's going to be in the pudding. But that leads us into the next article, Drew, which is that Cisco completes the BroadSoft acquisition. So just in case you think Cisco is a networking company, it's worthwhile remembering that BroadSoft is a cloud-based IP telephony provider and collaboration platform. Mm-hmm. They've completed the acquisition for $1.9 billion. And I see this as actually Cisco walking away from its traditional networking roots. You know, obviously HyperFlex and UCS is the same thing, but this is going further. It's actually betting its company as much on other products as well as networking. It's worth just keeping that in mind. And that acquisition has actually completed.
All right, well done. Okay, moving on from there. The website Axios recently reported on a government memo that proposes the United States should build a nationalized 5G network rather than have it be built and owned by private industry.
Yeah, you know, there's a big cynical button inside me that just got hammered. Like, it's like a big hammer just hit me on this. So it's just a white paper from some minor functionary inside of the U.S. government. And basically what he's proposing is that the U.S. government should build a 5G infrastructure and then let it share it to any of the U.S. telcos. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the reaction was hysterical just about everywhere. That would actually be what would be called world's best practice. The government should own some of the infrastructure and then make it available for private businesses to innovate on when it comes to telecommunications. The US is the only country in the world where the fiber in the ground or the spectrum and the networks are actually owned by the telcos, right? Everybody else uses shared infrastructure, shared towers, shared everything.
Well, I will say the spectrum is actually owned by the U.S. government and they license it out to private industry, but everything else, the fiber, the poles, the towers, all that is private, yeah.
And so the idea was that to get the 5G network in as quickly as possible, that the U.S. government would mandate federally that build the network, access to poles, access to power, mm-hmm. you know, right-of-ways, all that would just be handled, and there wouldn't be a possibility for, you know, the telcos to prevent this from happening. And the major concern here was, of course, one was innovation, speed of business, but the big one was security concerns. They're very concerned that the U.S. Companies might come in, as the European and American companies collapse. Like we've seen Ericsson report a $1.9 billion loss. Nokia is struggling to get its 5G portfolio together. Cisco and Juniper's 5G isn't actually up to scratch. They don't really have a strong story around 5G. It's very messy inside of the 5G. So the Chinese company or the Chinese infrastructure suppliers are very well placed here. So it become a security beat up. We wouldn't want the Chinese installing our 5G networks. They might be able to see secrets, etc.
That was very much a driving concern of this memo, that we can't let the Chinese, one, build this infrastructure for us, and two, essentially leapfrog us in technological innovation by building a national 5G network in China that allows them to advance things like self-driving cars and building out AI and machine-to-machine and IoT, and so with the U.S. sort of being left behind by this, you know, patchwork private industry standard.
So then I turned to my motto of inspirational cynicism, and I thought, you know, if I wanted to shake down political donations from the telcos, how would I do it?
Yeah. I can imagine, the moment this memo got floated around, that the lobbyists for AT&T and Verizon were writing checks to their local congresspeople.
So, you know, they've just been handed net neutrality and like billions of dollars in potential profits for various reasons. And so what reason have they got to donate for the upcoming midterm elections? And the answer might be...
This white paper.
Yeah, I've always felt like the communications infrastructure should be thought of as an interstate highway system, right? It really performs the same kinds of functions for data as the interstate highways has for commerce in the past. So it's an interesting idea. I don't know. I don't have the stomach for politics, so we'll have to watch and see.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I will say I think there are strong arguments that could be made for a nationalized telecommunications infrastructure. Like you said, Greg, a lot of countries in Europe do this. The government builds out the infrastructure and then
not
they license
Europe,
it.
Not just Europe, but Asia Pacific, everywhere, but right. America.
Yeah, yeah, and they license it out to competitive, to companies to compete. My feeling is with this current administration, it's a nationalized infrastructure is just not going to happen.
Seems unlikely, but nice try.
It's go read the paper. It's really fascinating, especially in terms of like ramping up the fears of the rising superpower of China and what that means for us. We have a link, so go check it out.
The white paper is quite rational and whatever, and it makes good sense. It lays out a good case. But finally, Ajit Pai, who of course is the chairman of the FCC, who recently repealed net neutrality, is violently opposed. He's absolutely furious, actually, if you read the articles going around. But of course, he's not getting much airtime because 84% of Americans are actually now opposed to net neutrality, which wouldn't be what he expected.
Opposed to network neutrality?
That's right. They believe in net neutrality. Ah, they're okay. Opposed to Ajit Pai.
Got it. Got it.
So he's
sense.
Not very popular. I doubt he's going to get much of a hearing.
Yeah. All right, well, let's take a brief break to talk about today's sponsor, WAN Summit. If you're constantly adapting your wide area network to accommodate new business requirements, technology, and applications, then WAN Summit is the place to learn how others are tackling key challenges like maximizing branch bandwidth while minimizing costs, supporting cloud applications, and more. WAN Summits are two-day program-intensive conferences that include case studies, interactive panels, and peer-to-peer networking opportunities. For example, at a recent WAN summit, a major U.S. retailer shared its entire migration process to SD-WAN, including lessons learned, how it chose a provider, and more. There's a WAN summit coming to a location near you that includes New York, London, Frankfurt, and Singapore. You can go to wansummit.com to find out more, and you can register there, and you can save 20% using the code PacketPushers. That's wansummit.com, and use the code PacketPushers to get 20% off. All right, back to the news. Doing a little financial news now. Juniper Networks, they reported their Q4 and full year financial results. The news really wasn't great. For the quarter, the company posted revenues of $1.2 billion. That is down 11% year over year with a net loss of $148 million. And for the year, the company had revenues just over $5 billion, which is up 1% year over year. Net income of $306 million. Unfortunately, that is down 48% year over year.
Yeah, it looks like Juniper got slammed with part of the tax bill. Some companies made out like bandits and other companies didn't. So maybe Juniper got hit that way. I think I did read a report from George Notto at Jefferies, who is an advisor to the big investment companies. He says that in his view that Juniper has been hit strongly by a weakening in the results of cloud customers. Mm-hmm. They had a particularly weak reduction in sales to the cloud companies with something like 30 to 40% reduction in sales. So I think what you're seeing there is that Facebook, Google, you know, the traditional names in the cloud companies who are buying Juniper MX and PTX series routers have now developed their own solutions and are starting to use those. There is some discussion around the Arista products, around the 7500R series, mm-hmm. actually being used as a router, not just as a switch in the spine. And if that's the case, then Juniper may have lost its traction in the cloud companies and may now be regretting turning away from the enterprise a few years ago because of they were having some problems and they thought they could double down on the cloud companies. And, you know, I think it seems likely that cloud companies are now able to do it themselves. And now we're seeing Juniper turn back to the enterprise and beefing up its Contrail SDN story.
Yeah, it's interesting to see in Juniper, in its press release about its financials, it said it put a lot of the blame for the results on the tax bill and how that's going to affect its income. And then to hear this story from George Notter, this analyst report saying this is not about any one thing. This is a long-term trend that's just going to be bad for Juniper going forward.
Mm. And then, of course, at Network Field Day this week, we saw them talking strongly about their Contrail product. And particularly, they've hired in some new people to run that business. So it might be, you know, you could conveniently draw a line from cloud sales dropping to revitalizing the Contrail and the enterprise business unit. So we'll see.
I think there's an interesting observation here that the gap between our hyperscalers and our enterprise is widening, and they're becoming very different, more different businesses, not more similar. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the industry responds to that. And are they going to have to pick and choose one way or the other? I don't know.
I think that decision's already been made. Cisco has zero sale, you know, very few sales to the big cloud companies. They keep saying they're trying to get back in, but I can't see how they would. You know, Arista continues to sell, but they make a chassis switch, which is very well suited to them. And for those companies to make a chassis would require a massive engineering effort that they're not yet ready to do. But for everybody else, you know, all of the other enterprises, we saw 6 months ago, we saw HPE say that their cloud companies have stopped buying their servers and they're giving up on that business. So, you know, Dell still supplies servers to some of those. The question is, you know, how much longer before they just do it all themselves as they keep building out those teams?
My take is that the big competition we're going to see in the enterprise going forward from the big incumbents, and I'm thinking specifically of Juniper, Cisco, and VMware, is that they're all battling over being the sort of virtualized network fabric for these organizations, both in the private data center as well as that on-ramp to the public cloud. So that's a lot about what Contrail was about. That was a big story coming out of VMware's presentations at Field Day about NSX. And of course, we just talked about what Cisco's up to and that Kubernetes and partnering with Google. So to me, I think that's where they see an opportunity.
In the SDN controller.
Yeah,
and selling software to enterprises is the future. And guess what? The cloud companies don't need software.
Right. They'll make it themselves.
Yeah, for sure. That's the way I see it, yeah.
All right, some news about Dell. In a filing with the SEC, Dell Technologies says it's considering a public offering or a possible merger with VMware, although the filing also says Dell may not do anything at all. And for some context, as you know, Dell Technologies went private. They own about 80% of VMware, which is still publicly listed. And when Dell bought EMC, they had to raise a lot of debt to do that, and they've still got about $46 billion in debt outstanding, so they're looking for some solutions.
Yeah, I think this debt is actually the key issue here. Dell is sitting on $46 billion worth of debt, and investors are now seeing enterprise IT companies as a poor investment. That is, there's no growth. It's probably shrinking. And they probably regret loaning Dell $46 billion, so they'll be pushing. So I think the lenders want their money back sooner rather than later. And Dell probably wants to get it off their books as well, because if they could reduce those interest payments, that would be a happy day. So Dell's actually said they're going to try out all different options, but the one that's rumored is they're going to do what's called a reverse listing, where you find a company on the share market and then you just take your private company and shove it inside of it. You make a share offering so that people can buy for the new expanded value. And of course, they've got a company that's listed on the stock exchange. It's called VMware. Why not shove it into that? That's just one of the options. So this has got a long way to run. Don't get too caught up about it. It's just Dell trying to find a way to pay down its debt by doing a public listing so that the private equity people can get a return sooner.
That's right. It was Silver Lake Partners that Dell went private with initially, and I'm sure they are wondering where their money is.
Well, they probably made money on putting the debt out to the bondholders, and they'll make money retiring the debt, and they'll also make money from...
You mean they'll be okay?
They'll probably be, you know, asking Dell to repay the debt so that they can take a fee out of getting the debt repaid, you know, and also to list the company, et cetera, et cetera. You never trust them.
That's right.
Well, and if you've watched VMware's stock over the last couple of weeks, it's been kind of a roller coaster. In response to this news, but also in talking with some folks that are on the sales side for both software and hardware vendors, you know, we've had conversations like, why would anybody want to start a career selling hardware boxes in this day and age? And I think this is reflective of that kind of mentality. The world's changing.
Yeah. Well, we've seen any number of activist investors get involved in enterprise IT firms. Look at Mellanox. Has got an activist investor. Riverbed was taken private by an activist investor by Thoma Bravo. You know, that story just goes on and on. And what they basically do is move in, kill off all the R&D or any product development, focus on reducing the costs internally and turning the businesses around. That is all a sign that enterprise IT is shrinking. And these people feel that by moving in and rationalizing the businesses, they can get quick profits, rip some quick dividends out of the companies and flip it and then run away again.
Yeah, well, I'm very curious to see how this plays out. All right, our last story for the day is our surfing dog story. Greg, you found this. This is about Switch Data Centers, which is a European provider of data center technology. They are talking about data center as a service. What is this?
Well, normally you'd think of data center as a service as public clouds, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe a colo facility, where you could go in and rent some servers or something like that. But no, this is actually, we will build your data center as a service. So Switch has actually patented a process by which they design and build out these data centers. And you can now go to them and they'll give you an end-to-end solution, including the racks and deployment of security technologies. Presumably that means physical security, so that you basically get a data center stood up and ready to go as a one-er. Instead of, you know, off talking to building contractors, off cooling to power to blah, 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 they're going to do it as basically a package deal. They just called it as a service, which was, you know.
I guess, you know, they had to, right? The marketing department was like, we have no other choice. It has to be as a service because that's...
That's right. Well, I think the interesting part here is, you know, customer data center ownership, they can do a full, you know, if you're somebody who's rebuilding a data center, which is still very popular, despite what people say, you know, you can actually go in and basically hire Switch as the primary contractor to do the whole thing for you. There's a lot of companies who are actually doing leasing of data centers. So if you're a colo provider and you just want, you know, if you're a bank or something and you believe investing in data centers is the way of the future, which, by the way, is a very good one because there's a lot of money to be made in building data centers right now and renting them out. So colos are often being rented out to clouds to a lesser or greater degree. It's a big business. So, you know, they're just offering a building of a data center as a service, but the data center as a service just struck me as deeply funny. Hi, I want data center as a service. Well, he's right in with the trucks and the power cables. We're coming. You know?
Can I pay with a credit card?
That's it. What a pay in installments.
That's right. All right. Well, that wraps up this week's news. Thanks to our guest, Yvonne Sharp. Yvonne, where can people find you on the web?
You can find me on the blog at esharp.net, on Twitter at Sharp Network, and check out thenetworkcollective.com for our podcasts and videos and interesting stuff.
Yeah, please do. It's good stuff. And stay tuned for our coffee talk conversation with VMware on NSXT. That's coming right up. You're listening to Coffee Talk, a fast, informative, sponsored conversation that gets you up to speed on interesting ideas in about the time before your coffee gets cold. We're sponsored today by VMware, and our guest is Nikhil Kelshikar. He is Senior Director, Technical Marketing in VMware's Networking and Security Business Unit. And we're going to talk today about NSXT. This is a version of VMware's NSX network virtualization software that can run on the KVM hypervisor and in containers, and it's designed for private and public clouds. Nikhil, welcome to Coffee Talk. And could you start us off by describing NSXT? Just what is it and how it's different from NSX?
All right. So NSXT is actually part of the NSX family. And as a part of that, we introduced this platform to the world about a year ago, close to a year ago right now. And it supports multiple different platforms. It starts with, obviously, it works on vSphere. It works on KVM, as you highlighted. We support containers. NSXT can also run in public cloud. So essentially, it runs on multiple different kind of workloads. NSX for vSphere is the platform which has been widely deployed by our customers and is deeply integrated into vSphere, right? Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, we have two platforms, NSX for vSphere and NSXT. The biggest thing about NSXT, as I told you, is that it is horizontal in breadth and supports multiple different platforms.
I think the point that's actually happening here, I think the thing that I have in my mind about NSXT is that we've always talked about NSX in the ESX hypervisor. But the reality of private cloud is that it's now extending into KVM hypervisors and containers. And we have to have a way to network them all together because the data is probably in an ESX hypervisor today. But tomorrow, some part of my private cloud might be in those other types of infrastructure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as it was discussed in one of the previous podcasts around this, our vision always has been about NSX being able to support every different endpoint. We call it NSX Everywhere, right? And to that end, you're actually, NSXT is the platform which makes that available. At the end of the day, you're going to have, when we look at just how workloads are evolving, you are going to see workloads, portion of it which runs in vSphere, other portions which run as containers on bare metal or in a hypervisor, and some other portion which may run in the cloud. And it is important from our customer's perspective to be able to have a consistent way to apply security policy, networking policy, which can extend across all of this. At the end of the day, the network has to go to places where the workload is going to go. And that's what NSXT enables.
So we're inside of containers, and you know, there's a lot of buzz around containers, and there's a lot of buzz around using KVM, obviously, because of the advantages of those, how easy they are to DevOps. And is there something different about NSXT, or does it look and run just like NSX, like the NSX agent? Are you using the same tool chains, or is there anything different?
So when it comes to NSXT, there are a few things which are different. For example, for NSX for vSphere, or NSXV as we call it fondly, right? it uses the vSphere UI, vSphere look and feel. You have a plugin within vSphere which enables you to do that. With NSXT, since you could conceivably use this purely on a non-vSphere environment, we have built an UI which is completely independent. From a vSwitch perspective, we use the vSwitch which is native to the platform. So as an example, on ESX, we leverage VDS, the vSphere distributed switch. On KVM, on Linux, we use the open vSwitch. And the NSX manager and the NSX controller can actually program, control these, and basically provide an API and everything across all of these points. So that's the core difference. To summarize, it is an independent management plane, control plane, and can be managed and controlled directly via NSX. You don't have to go through the vSphere web client to get there.
So if I'm familiar with NSX, I presume it's not going to take a lot of ramp up for me to also become familiar with NSXT.
From an operations perspective, from a process perspective, it's going to be fairly similar, right? So we have basically brought on the concepts which we perfected over the past 4 years. As you can see, we have thousands of customers now in production with NSX for V, and they have been able to make that change, and those customers will be able to find this in a very similar construct. Terminology, the key things are very similar. You're absolutely right.
I've got to get the terminology right. I should have said NSXV and NSXT because there's now two versions.
Well, I mean, actually, so one of the things which is important to what we have done for our customers, I mean, we realize that there are customers who are going to have to, shouldn't have to pick, right, whether they want to do V or T because they may have use cases for both. So when customers buy NSX, they actually buy NSX. They get entitlement to use either of the products. So they can deploy NSXV or NSXT, and that's a choice which is up to them, right? So they don't have to pick one or the other when they're trying to buy. This is actually an important point. So it is what they buy is NSX. So you're kind of right there.
Well, that's interesting because the licensing is becoming a major issue for customers. So simplicity in licensing, I think, is a key issue. Now, what about NSXT and Kubernetes and containers? Is there anything specific about that? Like, does the NSXT integrate with Kubernetes as such, or does it?
This is an interesting point, right? Thank you for bringing it up. I mean, one of the things we did, it's actually a recent release, the NSXT 2.0 and the recent NSXT 2.1 release. We have introduced a container network interface, CNI plugin, for NSXT. What that means is that as soon as you use Kubernetes to deploy a container or provision a container onto a container host, right, which could be a bare metal workload or a VM running within a hypervisor, NSX knows the metadata from that Kubernetes YAML file, like what was the name of the container or what is the name of the container pod and so on and so forth, and automatically provisions a logical network, the distributed firewall rules, load balancers, all of these things are available to the container itself. So all of that DevOps tool change and how basically somebody could say kubectl create or kubectl deploy, all of that would automatically flow through to NSX, right? Mm. So the developer can actually consume Kubernetes the way they were doing, and the infrastructure team can provide networking and security natively, right?
So the network engineer still sees NSX or, you know, whoever's running the infrastructure. A lot of as the infrastructure converges, it could be anybody. But, you know, if they make a call on the Kubernetes API to do the networking, you know, the container network interface, then NSX will just update its configuration and present that to the infrastructure perspective.
Absolutely. And now think about the beauty of this is that at the end of the day, you're going to have, there is no application which is purely built as microservices, right? There could be some things which are set talking to a database, which may sit be a SQL server or a VM or something sitting out there, right? Or sending information to a physical workload perhaps. And with this integration, now you can have the same policy extend from physical to containers to thing. And you can create like a firewall rule which says all of these container pods for application front end should talk to my database only on the following ports.
So does this mean, it sounds like you're saying the developers who are building applications, maybe using containers, using Kubernetes, they don't need to know anything necessarily about the networking underlay because NSXT is handling all that for them and it's controlled by the network or the security side of the house?
Absolutely. They don't need to.
Okay. That makes things easier.
There is very little friction, right? I mean, the whole point is that infrastructure should be very easy and the app should be able to be deployed wherever they want to. That's the whole point of building some of these things as microservices.
Now, what about multi-cloud? We've seen a lot of stuff come out from VMware recently about VMware on AWS and this idea of building hybrid clouds. Does NSXT have a role to play there?
Yes. So NSXT is a big piece of the underlying infrastructure. So when you look at NSX Cloud, that service is based on NSXT. So NSX Cloud is our service where you can get networking and security policies in a public cloud like AWS for native Amazon workloads. And the basis of building that service was leveraging NSXT. Now, similarly with NSX VMware Cloud in AWS, we're looking at some of these things, right? But as you look at some of the cloud services, the platform itself doesn't matter as much as the capabilities and the consistency of the capabilities, right? And you get the same policy, same control model from a capability perspective in the cloud because they use the same platform.
So does this mean, would I be able to have policies and controls that are identical or that match based on from my private cloud into a public cloud environment?
Absolutely. That's what it means.
I like that. I mean, this is where we're headed for, is because as you get the network going into the public cloud and in the private cloud, you know, we've been fairly clear that the evidence and the surveys and the customer feedback that they're providing to you is that they're going to do something in the public cloud. Nobody knows quite how big or how much of it there'll be, and that will play out over time. But this ability to have one network everywhere, I think, is what customers are looking for.
Yes, and keep in mind, there is not one cloud, right, which a customer may use. They may use, truly, when we are talking to customers, it's a multi-cloud strategy, right? You're always going to have workloads on-prem in your private cloud. You're going to have some workloads running in Amazon, some in Azure, potentially some in Google, right? Mm. At least more than one. At that point, if you had to create the challenges, how do you manage all your policies consistently across all of this if you don't have the same tool chains and the same infrastructure to actually get, for example, if I write a firewall security rule, it has to be able to be enforced the same way. I need to manage the policy from a single point of view. Having the single enforcement point like NSX, which can run across in multiple clouds, fundamentally makes that possible.
Yeah, I guess what you're trying to say there is that a security aspect is just as important as the networking aspect. What customers use NSX for is that micro-segmentation and even more so the firewalling functionality.
Especially when it comes to cloud, a big portion driver of that is the security aspect of it, because you want to be able to enforce security consistently, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Within on-prem, it is actually the networking, NAT functionality, routing, all of that. But when you go to the cloud, you're assuming that you could be routed over there.
So are you seeing people use NSXT then as a firewall, as well as a router, as well as a secure overlay mechanism, all in one? Normally, you would have to go into the public cloud, you'd have to build firewalls in VMs, and you have to pay for licenses, and you have to burn resources, you know, ES instances in the cloud to run your firewalls. You're actually saying that people are just replacing all of that with NSXT?
They are augmenting what they have. We believe that they're augmenting what they have in the public cloud with NSXT, with having a consistent security policy, right? So instead of having solution A on-prem and a solution B on-prem, or using a firewall from a security vendor on-prem and using AWS security groups and Azure's way to create security ACLs and things, right? Consistently across gives you a single pane of glass where you can do this. That's the vision where customers want to get to. And that's what we are delivering.
Yeah, because understanding the way that Google does networking is radically different from the way that AWS thinks about networking. They don't use the same language. They don't even have the same functional models of how they deploy VLANs, for example.
Exactly.
Much less security. You know, setting up AWS security and matching it to Google security is no mean task.
And then, but more importantly, now you also get one of the things you're actually seeing, and I will, maybe you are hearing it from customers you talk to as well, is for managing security and many of these tasks, people are doing it as APIs calls, right? They want to manage it as code. Security is effectively captured as a part of the deployment process within the application that this is what I want, right? And having three different APIs doesn't make things easy.
What I like about it is that it's probably not the network engineer who's deploying the security. It's somebody else's fault. Sorry, did I say that out loud?
I don't think I heard you.
All right, well, that wraps up this Coffee Talk episode. Thanks, Nikhil, for being here, and thanks to our sponsor, VMware. And of course, we appreciate you, our audience, for listening. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.